where we look at the ebb and flow of research on districts and research that, for example, Meredith has done as well as Hannah, to say we really need to focus our attention back on whether or not and to what degree the district has a role in improving student achievement, advancing equity, and if they do, what does that role look like? And today we can have a diversity of papers to consider that. And you'll see that while we say that we're framing them within districts, how we see the district as a participant in reform varies. And so towards the end, Meredith will take some time to, in addition to her general comments, talk a little bit about how we define the district or how we should consider defining the district. What does it mean when we're going to talk about doing district research? What should we look for when we're, for example, doing literature reviews on districts? How do we qualify that this research versus this? This is about districts, this is not. How do we disentangle the nested nature of districts, for example? We're going to give 12 to 15 minutes for each paper because we only have three presentations. If you don't have that, that's fine, but if you have the 12 to 15 minutes, that's good. What I'll do is at the 10-minute mark, I'll let the authors know that you have 2 minutes, but that means you'll have up to five. And that's my flexible nature. That and yesterday when I was trying to tell one author, your time is up, they did this. So, it's late in the game and I'm not feeling like participating in a hostile environment. So with that, why don't we have each of the authors introduce yourselves and just tell the title of your paper and then we'll come back and start.
Judith Mummy from here in San Antonio.
Tony Rooster Wood here in San Antonio as well, and our paper is entitled Data Coaching, Meeting the NCLB Challenge Through Collaborative Leadership and Systemic Coaching.
Oh, Linda Skirlis, Texas A&M, with them.
I'm Hannah Maloney from the University of Maryland. And
I'm Jackie Hodge, I'm the superintendent of schools in the school system outside of Baltimore.
And I'm Cheryl May, graduate student at the University of Utah, and the title of my paper is Organizational Response, How a Title I Elementary School Responds to Accountability.
Andrew, do you want to go first?
Yes.
Okay. You want to comment us? You can stand and talk, sit and talk.
Stand and talk.
Okay. You were part of this, so feel free.
Sonia and I are central office administrators with an urban suburban school district here in San Antonio that has 60,000 students. And the paper describes the journey our district undertook that encompassed about 3 years. Involves Linda and Jim Sherrick, who assisted us along the way. And it really describes what we did in response to No Child Left Behind, and particularly focused on the impact of No Child Left Behind on traditional special education practices within a district. If the intent was that all students would make progress in the standards as defined by the state, and an accountability task would be used to assess student progress, then the challenge for traditional special education practices is that for many years we have served special ed students at a functional level. And that word functional is one that we've done a lot of debating about over the past year. But essentially, No Child Left Behind says it does not matter the functioning level of the child. We are measuring a child's progress against a specific standard. Another traditional practice that we've seen a challenge to is serving special ed students outside of the general ed classroom. So what we have found is that if we're to meet that intent or purpose of No Child Left Behind, it's going to require an alignment of instruction within the district so that instruction is aligned with the assessment that students are going to participate in for all students within the district, and that the leadership in the district at all levels, from central office down to the classroom, is critical and is definitely required at all of those levels if we're going to achieve those goals and find success.
Through this journey, we did several book studies and had a lot of discussions on many levels. And we started off, I guess this was, when did we do this book study? It was 2003?
3 years ago.
We looked at the Leadership for Equity and Excellence that Jim Sherrick and Linda Skirla co-edited, and found several core pieces that became our mantra. So we found several quotes and then the four central beliefs that we found ourselves repeating over and over and over again. And central office did, the schools did the same thing, and our teachers did the very same thing. And one of the main quotes just flew by. It is not enough for the social justice leader to believe these things or to do these things himself or herself. It is his or her responsibility to work with all staff to develop an equity consciousness in teachers and other school staff members. And these four central beliefs we have discussed and debated and unpacked again on numerous levels. All children are capable of high levels of academic success. Academic success equitably includes all student groups. Adults in schools are primarily responsible, and traditional school practices result in inequity and must be changed. The one that really, number three, was probably a big, the biggest piece of change in our school district, because a lot of principals would have discussion, well, I'm not really the expert in that area, I really leave that to the teachers, or different kinds of things that led them to the decisions that they had made about where kids were educated, where they receive their instruction, was it in a general ed classroom or a special ed classroom. And we just decided that the adults, that we are responsible, we have to do what is in the best interest of the kids, regardless of the parents. We have to work as partners with them, but we have to do what we feel is best.
How about number four?
That again was the hardest one, because there's a lot of, especially with special education students and even ELL kids, which we'll get into a little bit later, but kids, special education students, for a very long time, I think we've been comfortable taking them out of the general education classroom. It's only been in the last 8 years or so where special education students are held accountable for their progress. So getting the kids into the general education classroom and having that be more than just geography, it's not just getting them in there, it's actually what happens when they're in there. We've done a lot of work on co-teach, co-funded CMCs, just different ways in which we can support kids in the general education curriculum. And it doesn't look the same for every kid, and that's probably been our biggest learning curve. It's not a program, it's not a package, it's very much a process, a dance that we do that's just really a constant kind of ebb and flow of data and discussion.
These statements from Sherrick and Skirla in one form or another have opened absolutely every meeting we've had with campus staff over the last 3 years. At one point, I had an elementary principal stand up and quote number four back to me in challenge to something that was being proposed. It was kind of an exciting day. Our initial reality, though, as we undertook this, we had students with disabilities served primarily outside the general ed classroom.
In fact, we had so many kids served outside the general ed classroom. In Texas, we have a list of school districts that have most of their special ed kids out of the general classroom for more than 50% of their day. And we had a permanent name plaque with our school district at the state level for being on this, what's called the 125% list. It was a real, we were very entrenched in special education kids having their own wing in the back.
So if kids were taught outside the classroom, it only made sense that they would be taught and assessed at a level which was their functional level, and that could be read as below grade level. 3 years ago, we had four campuses identified in the state accountability system as being unacceptable, academically unacceptable, solely on the basis of performance of students with disabilities. For a school district such as Northeast that prided itself on ranking rather high in the state accountability system. This was a situation that required a fairly massive response because it was not an acceptable situation.
What we learned from the process that several things. One of them is that the accountability systems are so complex that it's easy to become confused. And we've had a lot of campuses last year and the year before who we had very difficult discussions about, do we do state or do we do federal? The federal accountability system, because in many ways they were in conflict with each other. So it took us, every time we came together with principals, we revisited, what does the state accountability system look like? What does this mean? What does this mean for us as a district? What does this mean for you as your campus? And we just revisited that over and over and over so that there was a general understanding of what the system was actually measuring.
I think something else that we learned along the way is that campuses cannot be left to their own devices to deal with an accountability system that has some very, very stringent consequences that are part of, and we've learned that it's critical that central office staff work very closely with the campus leadership team, monitor along the way, and ensure alignment of both instruction and assessment. And I think the last thing we've learned is that principals absolutely must take responsibility for decisions made for individual kids on their campus. We found in many cases principals had been delegating that responsibility to teachers, teachers, to the assistant principal, to the school psychologist assigned to that campus, and were not aware of decisions that had been made that impacted the school's accountability rating.
Our cycle, it's a circle. We have a visual for you in a few slides. But the process that we really focused on was to reflect. Reflect, revise, and retool. And we just continually revisited the same premise over and over, getting depth with each time we would go around the cycle. We looked at our data very carefully. Let me talk about the data searching process, about how we did this.
Reflecting included the book studies, the careful examination of the data, digging deep enough to find out exactly how did we compare to other districts in the state.
Looking at the practices, this moves into the data searching framework. We did this in a way that was a small group of people that we looked individually at each school. So we assigned a group of data searches, which came from curriculum and instruction, ed tech, and special education, to do all of these practices individually with each school. The shift that we moved into was really our principals and our instructional leaders. They became instructional leaders. They really moved beyond the managing of a school, and they could tell you about the Marzano strategies and all the different instructional pieces that we worked so hard to see evidence in the classroom.
So this is one outcome in terms of looking at where kids were served. This just tracks where special ed students in our district were served over a period of years compared to the state, with the state line being in red. The state trend over a period of years has been toward more and more kids served in inclusive settings. That trend has also finally become reflected in our district. And at this point, that last doc shows 17% of special education students served outside of general education. That's now dropped to 13% this fall. The state has fallen to 20%. But this was part of the retooling process, abandoning strategies and ways of serving kids that really were not working.
This is the cycle. Once the data coaching frame came from an article in Harvard. Journal, and it's based on a Harvard classroom that worked with administrators
in a graduate school type setting where they actually did this data coaching process. And so we borrowed that idea and then tweaked it and made our own and met with the principals. They came up with their data coaching team that consisted of maybe an assistant principal, different grade level chairs or content level chairs, just whatever issues. If they had ELL on their campus, it was their ELL person, special education. Just they were able to craft their own teams. And we visit this cycle over and over again. We choose the focus, what's evident in our data that we really need to take a look at. Dig deeper, what is that about? Unpack it, how come this is going on? Agree on the problem, ask why, that's the revisiting, the retool. Examine current practices, develop an action plan, which will involve sometimes abandoning some things, adopting some other things, implement action plans, and on and on. The data coaching piece has been very, very powerful. We have found that the power is in the questions that we ask. We have 2 minutes. This is how my... So we've really learned that the power in this whole process is the questions. We have nothing. They know their kids. They know their campus. We just ask the questions as kind of outsiders looking in. How is it that you've come to this? And what needs to happen to change or move something forward?
There's the 4 assignments that we worked on last year. They were so successful, we've rolled them into the plans for this year. Assignment 1 was really interesting. Principals were asked to prepare a PowerPoint that analyzed the campus data and initial steps that they were going to take on that campus. They presented it to their faculty at the beginning of the year. In October, we asked the team from each campus to come in and meet with their data coaches. They brought data on special ed students, on English language learners, on any child who had failed a portion of last year's test, meaning that child was at risk. They were putting a face on the data. It wasn't a 23% failure rate. It was how many kids and in what ways did they fail and how badly had they failed. Assignment 3 occurred in January and was basically a review of what their intervention plans were. And assignment 4 was last June. Every campus came back in with their results from state accountability. There were no unacceptable campuses. The district was once more with a smile on its face, with many, many schools looking very, very good. We had phenomenal success with our special education students.
Yeah, and a powerful piece in this process was giving the administrators tools to analyze and look at their data, tools to present the data back to their staff. We had several principals upon that assignment number 1 who had never done a PowerPoint. So it was just scary and frightening, but exciting at the same time. It's been an interesting journey. And again, this shift has caused our principals to become instructional leaders. They know exactly what's missing in instruction, what holes and what gaps do we need to fill in instruction across the
board. One of the interesting things with assignment 2 when they were asked last year to come in October was lists of students who had not done well on state accountability tests the year before. We had a couple of campuses call and tell us that they really did not believe this was going to be helpful for their campus and they were going to pass on the opportunity. I'm here in place of the associate superintendent who herself made a phone call and said, we're going to need to see you. We'll give you an extension of 3 days. This year, it has been an amazing turnaround in terms of dealing with campuses. We just about finished the second round of data coaching this year. They've come in with lists of kids, but what's been really exciting is that they've come in with... It's a song and dance, but it's exemplars. We've had campuses walk in and post student work and reports of what percent of teachers are carrying out specific initiatives as measured by 16, how many ever walkthroughs were being carried out by campus leaders.
So to wrap it up, we have a final quote. To recreate an equitable and excellent classroom in school, we need to make the commitment to do this part of our effort. Every day, every week, we need to reaffirm our commitment to this.
a righteous journey, a democratic journey, and a spiritual journey, and it has been just that. And we're moving.
But it is not a 100% success story. Analysis of last year's data indicates that special ed students are not the lowest performing kids in the district. It is our English language learners, which is a real focus of what we're working with campuses on this year.
So the good news is we know what to do. We know where we're going.
I'm going to pass this out and I'm Hannah Moy from the University of Maryland, Jackie Hawes.
I'm going to go ahead and start because our 12 minutes are going to go fast. Okay. I am the superintendent in a school system of about 40,000 and plus students and growing because of the space realignment who's sending 10,000 jobs our way. And we're located about 30 miles northeast of Baltimore. The initial work that Hannah and I did together, the initial work came out of my dissertation, but we've continued to partner, which I think is an exciting thing to see projects reported and studies reported throughout this conference. What I want to begin it with is just give you a little background about where Maryland is. Maryland began in the accountability movement, first as sort of a trial balloon in 1991, but then with its own set of accountability tests from 1992 until we had to shift into the present mode under No Child Left Behind, and the testing that Maryland was using initially for 10 years almost was criterion reference testing, and then we all had to shift to a new test. So, you know, that sense of urgency and the confusion, and in that process, Maryland also began with what was called a voluntary state curriculum. Voluntary, haha. But, you know, that was another shift, that all the standards and what we were expecting at different grade levels in Maryland was also shifting. As a superintendent, obviously, I had 50 plus schools that were going to try to figure out how they were going to retool from where they were under the initial Maryland program and now shift into a new gear, a new test, new set of standards, new curriculum expectations. And in looking at the literature as a doctoral student, one of the things that became very apparent is the things that you've heard throughout this conference, that we had these islands of excellence, but how were we going to get a coherence across the system where everybody had a sense that they were working in a meaningful way, that they were supported by each other and supported by the district, balancing that need to have that coherence across the district, but yet have some flexibility in meeting the individual needs of the campus, and yet knowing that as a superintendent, I really needed to have a sense that we were together moving in a similar direction. In reviewing all of the case studies that were available at the time, such as District 2 in Chicago and Philadelphia and so forth, it really became apparent that professional learning was a real focus of the success stories that were out there. It was interesting to hear Richard Elmore talked today about some of the work that he was involved in. And I kind of viewed it like he did. This is really a promising kind of area. And so what we did was we decided as a leadership group at the district level that we were going to try to implement professional learning communities across the school district in all of our schools so that we would be developing a culture that could sustain learning and therefore continue to adapt using whatever cycle. We ended up using classroom learning systems, plan, do, study, act cycle, but using an action research cycle within those professional learning communities to figure out how do you continue to learn about how to meet the needs of your students better and continue to learn to provide better classroom practice and better instruction every day. So we set about doing that, and in reviewing all the literature, we found that there were about 10 different consistent types of strategies or actions that the school districts had used in those case studies that are available. And so we, as a district, set forth a structure called a central instructional leadership team, who were the actors and deciders at the district level to make decisions about what was the professional learning activities going to be, what were the structures and so forth. We similarly set forth a structure at the school levels called an ILT, an instructional leadership team. One of the major things that we did was take about 46 people out of central office who had been federally funded mentors, teacher specialists, assistant supervisors, and so forth, and put them back onto all the campuses as instructional facilitators and coaches, and not add people, but move them back so that they were right here on the campus working with the administrators at that school. The other thing that I would tell you is that we specifically articulated and planned a year-long, year-by-year, we've done this each year, professional development calendar and set of events and activities that cycles everybody through, the ILTs, the instructional leadership teams at the schools. They come through as individual people, such as the assistant principals, the instructional facilitators and mentors come to training and so forth together, constantly cycling everybody, getting the same treatment in these early couple of years. The story continues and it's a little different now, but in this study, that's kind of how it was. So with that as a brief background, what we want to tell you about is while we've done many studies that have extended from the original work that I did, and I love working with Hannah in this way, this particular study starts to look at how the context affects what goes on in those individual schools if you see a differentiated response from what the central instructional leadership team does. So I'll let you go from there.
Great. I'm going to, there's actually a page behind it, so I did not bring that, and I actually apologize. I'm sure Meredith didn't want to read the 100 pages, but let me just go back and say that what we have in this work is trying to situate the research that we've done in two phases, the setting a baseline rate at in 2003 as the district began the reorganization by surveying the district teachers, all 2,300 of them, to determine if their collective efficacy beliefs. And if you want to take a look at table figure 7, you have a sort of walkthrough of what we did, and I'll speak very quickly to that because I really want to share the work that we did for this right now. So in this logic of action, and I don't have this on the PowerPoint, folks were kind enough to share that, but you'll see that the top is just a set of actions that the district did very systematically from planning in 2002 to actually beginning the first year of implementation. And in the analysis, which comes out of Jackie's dissertation, she really stopped and took a look back and said, gee, what did we do after 2 years? So in the second column, you'll see we've used a kind of organizational framework of structural, political, individual, and cultural systems. And one of the first things we did after sort of the baseline study was to kind of stop and say, well, gee, we did a survey, and here are the district actions. You know, how do these line up when you look holistically across a fairly large system? And so there were two elements to the surveys that we began with. First was the professional learning communities model, which you see in the bottom half of this table. And we used Sherry Hoard's survey, and we have some great colleagues here who we weren't able to use your survey early enough, but we found that it was very, very useful. It gave us a picture of the conditions before the district did anything in terms of the profile of professional learning communities across the dimensions that you see here. But we also added some items that had to do with collective efficacy beliefs because we just felt that might be a bit of glue. There were three items that we used in 2003. And for you, many of you know Bandura's work, but this has really become a cornerstone of what we've done as we've gone forward. Because what we found using Bandura and Goddard and Hoy's work is, of course, collective efficacy is a cultural property and it's kind of a collective set of beliefs on the differential effect of on student achievement. And it's, as you can see, a construct from social cognitive theory that we've gone back to look at. I'm going to go through this very quickly since Jackie, you can read about it. But essentially then, we wanted to see what happened after the district engaged in really trying to set up and support collective learning and the elements of a professional learning community that are laid out here. And in the work of the mentor and the instructional facilitator who were moved to schools to help in building relationships and so on. So what we want to do, just fast forward, is look at the second phase of this, which was in the second year of implementation, 2005. Jackie again gave the survey, but we had by that time begun to think that we needed to learn a little bit more about the nature of collective efficacy. And so there's another part of this study we have deals with how we looked at that. But then we wanted to take a look at the differences in 10 schools that Jackie had originally looked at as we began this process. And see how they, in both the beginning survey and in the follow-up survey and through the qualitative data, what we could learn about their trajectories and their pathways. So I'm going to go to these. These are just key findings. So I want to step back now. See, as we began to really look at deeply the data that you see in different versions in the two tables here, became clear that there were some patterns that were really clearly emerging that came out of the theory that says that really a collective efficacy theory, that would mean that if you have like a really high contextual challenge, which would mean either poverty, high poverty in our case, percentage of
77%,
right? And as opposed to a low contextual challenge school, then if you think about the relationship between potentially a very low professional learning community and a high professional learning community, we began to see as we did our analysis that they're potentially kind of more or less quadrants here. So that you could have, and we have, I'll show you in a minute, contextually challenged but advancing learning communities. And in fact, the theory of collective efficacy would say these guys are going to move pretty fast because they have had to struggle to go forward. So this is the latest kind of development of the work we're going to do. So now I'm going to just go to a sort of quick overview of how we laid out this 10 schools that we've laid out, that we've studied. First, this is a kind of profile of, this is a profile of the of 10 schools. There are the round circles are elementary schools, the squares are middle schools, and the long skinny thingies are high schools, the odd thing. Now, green represents collective efficacy beliefs in 2003 that were above the district mean. Collective efficacy beliefs, the brown, below the district mean. Now, one of the things that was really significant, not surprising for everybody here, is that, in fact, there are significant differences in mean collective efficacy and mean not readiness for professional learning community. Between elementary, middle, and high school. But for the purpose of a district looking at these, it's clear here that at least beginning this whole process, there were only three of the schools that had a sense of collective efficacy. There were a fair number that were sort of, at least initially, perceived themselves to have conditions of professional learning community present. I'm going to skip to the next one. Just hold on to this. And in 2005, this is what the profile looks like. So you have, you might say, a coloring up of collective efficacy. Now, along with this, if you read the data, and it's, we have on the last page grouped the schools in bands, in levels. And you can see the picture will be different because we've grouped the middle, the high school, and the elementary separately. And so the means move for each of those. Much lower for high school, typically, much not as low as in both cases for middle school and then the elementary school. But the really exciting news about this picture here is that you have, if you can sort of get the gist of what we're trying to do here, you have up in this corner contextually challenged, and these are really open elementary is the most challenged school. That's why it's so high up here. They're placed right here. These are less challenged, but they're still challenged schools. And you have a middle school as well. So you have this shift, and in a slide that I'm not showing, in fact, we have mapped on the increases in the percentage of students meeting state mandated achievement in math and in reading. I just didn't have time to put this on, but these schools are, as the theory here would predict, sorry, I can't get this thing to light up here. Oops, go back.
That's right.
They are moving along. So one of the things that's kind of interesting here, that we think is exciting and interesting, is that it seems as if a district can be very intentional and mindful and make moves. It's really useful and important to think about tracking both across and deeply. We will continue to do that.
And differentiating then, I'll go back to that point. Differentiating. We've noticed that they have to have a differentiated response from us. So different treatment, so to speak. And that's really what we're starting to do much more of now. So.
It's really interesting listening to these other two presentations. They gave a broader picture, big picture of districts and how they're addressing accountability. Accountability has been a really important issue for me. At times, as I worked through my dissertation, I actually had a hard time deciding at which level I wanted to focus on. I was interested, you know, in the national level, the state level, and the district level. And I finally actually ended up focusing on one elementary school because I really wanted to see the impact of all of this on the children. And so that's where I ended up with my focus. And my paper summarizes the findings of my qualitative study on a Title I elementary school. During the first 2 years of No Child Left Behind, Bridges Hall Elementary, and all the names I use are fictional, of course, a Title I elementary school with approximately 625 students did not make annual yearly progress. The school in the past did not perform adequately regarding scores for Hispanic students, especially. Hispanic students account for approximately 21% of the student population. During the last 2 years, the school has made AYP, but it was recently released that the school did not pass the state separate accountability system this past year, which was kind of interesting, I thought. Anyway, the study specifically examined how the school is responding with regard to educating students of color and how the district supports the school's responses to accountability. So even though my focus was on the individual elementary school and the children there, I was also really interested in how the district was helping that school with their efforts. I addressed three research questions. Number one, how has the school responded to state and federal accountability mandates to improve student performance? Two, how are the school's responses to these mandates supporting supported by the district? And three, how did the school's responses address learning and performance of students of color? Data collection for this study included focus group and individual interviews, observations, and document analysis. I interviewed numerous district officials, including the staff development director, curriculum director, the supervisor over NCLB compliance, reading specialist, curriculum supervisors, the assistant superintendent, and the superintendent. I also interviewed over one-third of the teaching staff, including the principal and six parents involved on the PTA board. Specifically, this paper focused on findings that relate to how the concepts of colorblindness and deficit thinking played a role in how the school and district responded when the school did not initially make annual yearly progress. Overall, teachers and administrators did not see the need to differentiate or design instruction to specifically target raising the achievement scores of students of color. So that was a little bit discouraging, those findings. Anyway, in conducting the interviews, four distinct responses to accountability emerged. District and school responses related to leadership, site-based decision-making, the district as a support system, and a focus on curriculum instruction and assessment. And I wanted to just kind of hit on those just briefly here. The first response, leadership. Participants felt that leadership was absolutely critical in responding to accountability. The district claimed that a new principal, David Anderson, was selected after the first 2 years when the school did not make AYP. He was selected on purpose because of his leadership skills and his ability to speak Spanish and make connections with the community. The new principal incorporated grade level teams, and he encouraged teams to use test data to identify areas of concern. They did something similar to what the first presentation talked about. He kind of set up those teams, but he let them just run themselves. And that's kind of where the leadership died. Mr. Anderson states that it's more important to analyze which individual students are not achieving instead of looking at groups of students. So he told those teams, use your test data, but look at the individual kids, let's find them. But he wasn't concerned with certain, you know, specific student populations. He and several district officials believe that low achievement is correlated to low socioeconomic factors and language ability issues rather than factors related to school efforts. Number two, site-based decision-making. The importance of site-based decision-making was cited as a second response in helping a school to improve. Participants felt that individual schools need to have local control over their efforts to improve. When Mr. Anderson was made principal of Bridges Hall, he, for the first time, was given discretion over Title I funds and how he could use those. Before that, I learned the district really kept tight control over the Title I funds, which was not what they were supposed to do. But as a response to not making AYP, the district decided that it might be a good idea for the principal to have more control over that. Mr. Anderson used the money to hire additional staff members in order to lower class sizes and increase aids. As part of the site-based approach, the school is also responsible for formulating the school improvement plan and determining the direction for future improvement efforts. District as a support system. The third response involves the district's role in addressing accountability. According to district officials and the principal, the district's role is to provide resources and moral support to the school in its efforts to increase achievement and maintain legitimacy, but never to criticize the school for failing to raise the achievement of certain populations of students. And this was kind of shocking to me, but that's how they saw their role. The principal and district officials claim that No Child Left Behind was adding additional stress onto the teachers who were already working in a very challenging environment. And they did not want to add to that stress. They felt that it was important for them to be supportive, even when a school didn't make AYP, and to reassure the teachers that they were doing a good job. And this was interesting, I thought too, because the district was so worried about No Child Left Behind and the effect on the teachers, but when you talk to the teachers, they verified the fact that the district was extremely supportive. And they also said that they didn't feel any pressure from No Child Left Behind. And they felt absolutely no pressure from the district. District officials also said that they support the school by providing staff development and other requested resources, but it is the school's responsibility to direct improvement efforts, not the district. And then the last response, focus on curriculum, instruction, and assessment. The participants mentioned that an increased focus on reading was one of the biggest reasons the school made AYP during the third year. Teachers were provided with training on reading strategies provided by the district, and the entire school implemented a program called Scatter Groups each day. During Scatter Groups, students were divided into groups and worked with teachers, reading specialists, and aides on reading. The principal and the teachers also believed a focus on assessment data was important in identifying individual students who are struggling, but that data was not used to identify student populations that were not achieving at adequate levels. With the exception of a couple of district officials, one parent, and one teacher, most of the participants did not feel it was necessary to consider culturally congruent curriculum and instruction to address the academic needs of students of color. Throughout the interviews, there was a general feeling that it was more important to help, quote, all students achieve. In addition, teachers also believed that the reason the school did not make AYP during the first 2 years was because of the student population. Deficit thinking was prevalent throughout the interviews. Teachers blamed students and cited students' lack of motivation, their parents' lack of interest in education, and students coming from impoverished backgrounds as being the reasons for the school not making AYP in the past. The interesting thing about this, when I did the focus group and they were giving me their reasons, I also asked them, what's your percentage of parents attending the parent-teacher conferences? And they said, oh, it's about 98%, which to me, I couldn't understand why they could say that the parents didn't care because they had all the parents there. So that was kind of an interesting thing. It appears that the school has used test data to begin to address academic achievement, but this becomes problematic when considering how assessment has been used in the past. As reported in the school's improvement plan in 2005, the overall scores at the end of level assessment increased from the previous year. However, as written in the school improvement plan, student groups maintained their same math level or only, quote, dropped slightly. In reality, the Hispanic population math score was 35% proficient in 2003, but only 27% proficient in 2004, a decrease of 8%. The school's community council highlighted the fact that the number of Caucasian students reaching proficiency had increased to 59% in 2004. Based on this fact, and essentially ignoring the 8% decrease in the Hispanic math scores, the decision was made for the school to continue to focus on reading and to discard the math focus. One area that was mentioned by many participants as affecting organizational capacity was the issue of teacher staffing. The principal felt strongly that the school would be more effective if practices were adopted to hire more experienced teachers for Title I schools. In this particular school, the teacher turnover was about 50% each year. So it was a lot. District officials expressed a desire to, district officials expressed a desire to explore methods to address this issue, but mentioned it was difficult because of negotiated teacher contracts. And their response was always, we're getting good leaders in there. Good leaders attract good teachers, but the teacher thing is going to be difficult. To summarize, overall, the teachers and administrators involved in this study appear to be genuinely interested in accountability and increasing achievement, but again, for, quote, all students. In addition, legitimacy management seems to be the major impetus for improvement for many participants, not closing the achievement gap for all students. In conclusion, increased district and school level discussion and staff development on deficit thinking, subtractive schooling, colorblindness, institutional racism, and whiteness theory could have potential benefit to further increasing the organizational effectiveness of the school. These are difficult topics for many people to discuss, but this discourse could have a positive effect on exposing issues that are currently preventing the achievement gap from being closed.
Can we give a round of applause to all of our
One of the things you learn when you have a two-year-old is that if you're the last man standing between someone and dinner, you better talk fast. So if I'm hungry, I'm going to take 15 minutes. I will not do that. So you can relax about that. Andrea asked me to address the issue whether districts have a role in improvement efforts, and if so, what is that role or how should we understand what that role is? And with regard to the first question, do districts have a role? I want to express what I hope is our collective wish, that we're going to stop asking that question. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, every time someone asks a question, you just want to grab them by the collar and throw them against the wall. I know. We've been studying this forever. I mean, it's clear. Of course, districts have a role. I mean, for decades, they've appeared in school studies as these major barriers to implementing a whole host of things. So obviously, they matter, at least in the negative sense. And, you know, even though for decades, federal policy has virtually ignored central offices, it doesn't anymore. I mean, central offices are specifically called on to deal with special ed, to support schools and dealing with special ed students, not just outside regular ed classrooms, but inside regular ed classrooms. Districts, it sounds like in your district, it was a voluntary effort to establish learning communities.
It was an expectation.
From the state.
No, oh, voluntary on our part, right?
Yeah, right. So voluntary on your part. But in some districts, they're perceiving a federal mandate to engage in the federal learning communities initiative or otherwise create these opportunities. You know, districts have to deal with AYP and other demands of No Child Left Behind. So, you know, districts are on the map in research and policy. And I think the question really becomes, what can we do as a research community to build a better knowledge base about districts? And I have a few wishes about that that I'm going to take the opportunity to share with you, which is what Andrea asked me to do. And there's some low-hanging fruit here when it comes to building this knowledge base. So I'm going to start with some low-hanging fruit. Linda's laughing because she thinks some of this fruit's on the ground. Because the first one, you know, the first thing we can do to build a knowledge base about districts is to study them. The UCA program, I'm new to UCA. As someone who's interested in districts, reading the UCA program, I think the program's weird. I mean, you could go to every single session about districts, which I know you probably have done, and you'd still have, you know, a day and a half to go through the Alamo and tour the rest of Texas. I mean, they're just, this is an associated, dedicated educational administration, and the program still, I hear there have been a lot of improvements over the years, so again, it's a comment from the new guy. But I think my understanding is educational administration also includes what people in central offices do in the context in which they work, which would include, you know, school boards and other people who exert educational leadership. And just as a topic of study, districts are strangely absent. And I hope one of the things we can talk about is why that is. So fruit on the ground is to study districts. In terms of how to do that, I think one of the things that we might think about doing as a research community is really clarify what it means to study a district. One of the things that I do is co-lead the special interest group for AERA on district central offices and research and reform. And as in that role, one of the things I do is receive proposals from people who want to make presentations on districts. And it's interesting to look at our pool of proposals each year, because often, even though we're the district SIG, we get a number of proposals that don't appear to be about districts at all. An example would be a study that's really about what schools do in implementing an initiative that a district might have initiated. But really, the main topic of the work is the school. So a lot of what we struggle with is, how can we signal to people what it would mean to take the central office or to take something district as the main unit of concern? And so I pose that as a question for you about how we could put better signals out to ourselves and to others in the research community about how we could focus on something that we might call districts. I wish that the studies we have that were about districts really got inside the day-to-day working of central offices. Too many studies, maybe because a lot of what we know about districts comes from studies in schools, too many studies still rely on principals' reports of what central offices do, a couple of interviews within central offices. I mean, there are people in these systems who have very interesting things to say, probably have very interesting, you know, day-to-day lives. We need to understand more about who you are and what you do. And it's the rare study that really gets inside the central office to ask questions about that work as the main concern. And given given the hundreds of thousands of people who work in central offices, the next step is for us to learn more about what that is. Some fruit that's higher up on the tree. I have three wishes here too. There have been a number of studies about, you know, who are school principals and sort of what's the pipeline into the principalship and what's the pipeline into teaching. Those have been really valuable studies to help us understand sort of who we're dealing with, especially the people who work in ed admin preparation programs. We don't have similar studies that deal with the pipeline into central offices. We all have a sense of who's there, but there have been, I can only think of one study that has really got the data set, the human resources data set, on who are the staff of central offices and tried to uncover where they come from and what they do. So, you know, part of our work should really be uncovering who these people are. One of the things that these papers are trying to grapple with is what would be productive roles for districts in dealing with a whole host of reforms. And one of the things that I would suggest is what those productive roles might be is, you know, we have some hunches about it, but it's largely unknown. I mean, we haven't really studied it. And it's possible that these roles haven't been invented yet. So my second wish, higher up, in terms of the fruit higher up on the tree, is that we'll do research that involves partnerships with people who are trying to support central office administrators, school board members, and others in trying to invent new roles for themselves around meeting some of these accountability demands, supporting things that they've never, you know, most administrators haven't even thought of supporting, like professional learning communities and schools. To study sort of the process of inventing those roles and what people go through in the process. And this relates to my third and final wish, which is that when we do these studies, we'll do our best to take a strengths-based approach. I mean, a lot of what you've heard described here in these papers in terms of what central offices are trying to do is extremely difficult work. Part of why it's difficult is we don't have a good conception of what central office administrators should be doing in their roles to support these kinds of reforms. And in my own work, one of the things that I found is that the absence of those role models is a major barrier to central office administrators actually participating productively in reform. So one of the questions that I'm trying to grapple with is, how do you understand central office administrators trying to phase in some of this new work over time, given that it will be difficult, given that there will be bumps in the road? So strengths-based approach.
I'd like to thank Meredith for agreeing to serve as the second. We had hoped to have other papers. Brendan McAfee was intended to be part of this symposium, and myself and Charlie Halpin are working on a fairly large project, so we're looking at two districts in Utah and seeing how their district improvement plans align and their school improvement plans to see how do they move from the intent to the actual action. And so she has kind of a difficult task preparing for today because we kept making our way for things that weren't coming. So thanks, Karen.
That sort of caps, you captured my life in a nutshell right
there.
There
you go.
Probably many of us. You may not have won.
But I think Meredith's point to let's work on defining the district and talk about the research agenda and how to move it forward and how to get people talking about districts in a way that it's not just, oh yeah, and by the way, this affects, you know, this is affected by or this affects districts as an add-on, but as something central to what's going on in schools. And so with the papers that have been presented and the comments from Meredith, let's open it up for discussion and dialogue and questions, concerns.
I've got a question that I think refers mostly to the first two papers, but by all means, feel free to jump in. The notion of data coaches, well, let's back up and take a larger view. The notion of coaches itself is, the research is varied on how to implement this and the degree of success to which you can do this and so on. And we can probably all think of really good examples and not so good examples of how this goes. My sense is that as researchers, we don't understand a whole lot about how the district can implement coaches past specific situations. So question one, do you agree with that? And question two, do you have any insight towards this? What I guess I'm talking more about in question two, things like scalability might be too big, but common things that need to happen. How can we make this happen in a school district that is not yours?
Well, I will send you our massive report, because a really central part of that is really, and Jackie needs to speak to this, is really the tracking of what occurs when you put mentor teachers and instructional facilitators and what the district did to support that, and trying to track out the effects. Well, one lesson I think just we've had a chance to talk about the data is that you saw a picture of the district in 2005, and Jackie, one of the things that we found was that there really is an implementation dip. It's hard work to start to move in and make changes. So actually, our mean readiness for professional learning communities kind of dropped. There's a lot of increase in variability. But in the quantitative analysis, what we found was across this district, from the perspective of the 2,300 teachers, the principal was really the key to creating a context of support. We were a little bit surprised. I was surprised, because I thought that the mentor teacher would have been much closer to that. But then we really realized that this was like year two, actually a full year. And I think, Jackie, maybe you want to pick up on that, but I think that's a really important point to share, because it takes the thing that it takes time, it really does take time.
How you get it into other systems, I think that it's about the structures that are there and how you use your resources, and then how you train your people, because the principals were supportive of the whole idea of creating the learning communities, because they were wanting to have those partner change agents assigned to their schools. So it was always a little bit of how do you play the political part of the give and take with principals who are very important in their own house, so to speak, because they have to be able to send the message, number one, that this is a good thing for us, and then this is why it's good. They have to be able to sell it. And in order for them to be able to sell it, they have to understand it. And that's the first gate you have to get through. And it takes a while to get principals. Your comment earlier was well taken about the PowerPoint. Principals are not always comfortable getting in front of their staff and teaching and sending a message about what is the vision, what is it we want for our kids here, and kind of bringing that all together. So I think part of it is just, it kind of goes back like a web into some of the other things we've talked about here, about how we prepare other people, how we structure and use our resources, how we structure and use the relationships between central office and schools, and what we do as central office people. And what does the superintendent do? What does the curriculum and instruction people do? All of those things are pieces of it. So it's not a linear process.
I have a comment. As Meredith said, we've been at this a while with successive studies, looking at districts that have gotten their act together and it impacted student achievement in a positive way. And the notion that central office rethinks how it uses its resources in a coaching manner for direct services to campus, and in some cases even central office people being a direct service to students, is really consistent across all the districts that we work with. And so you sort of take that idea to Northeast, this is is really cool in that it's an ongoing relationship of, we had some earlier work, we all know one another, we kind of move in and out with working with them and learning from them and actually getting to, like, something else Meredith said is, you know, they're sort of inventing new roles, you know, for new challenges. But this district is very good and has been very good, and they'd already done kind of the easy stuff of, you know, curriculum alignment and, you know, they've gotten benchmarks. Yeah, they've gotten the big pieces of, you know, district reform together, and we're getting some progress. And then they're really moving on into interfering with, you know, holdover traditional practices. And the point I'm trying to get to is I think leadership is really, really important. They have a really strong superintendent. The deputy superintendent for Alicia Thomas for instruction is very strong and very knowledgeable and knows where all the bodies are buried. And, you know, if you're going to have these coaches do their work and be held accountable, it requires that pressure from the top, and that it be insistent the campuses play ball and that the coaches work.
And be held accountable.
Right. It's a frame. The day of coaching, we have the expectation, and that's our rigor, that this is the standard we all must get to. The data coaching is really just a frame that is built on relationship. And so we've got our kind of our mantras, and it's rigor, relationships, and relevance. The data coaching frame allows people to come in and sort of unpack what are our problems here? What are the big issues? And so you've got to get comfortable and have that relationship for principals to come in and say, we've got a problem in this particular classroom, this particular group of students, and you've got to have a certain level of comfort to get there. It's also very hands-on. We are rarely in our offices. We are out and about with teachers and classrooms with students, and try to cultivate a very, you know, systemic piece of we're all in this together. If you need extra help with this particular group of students, we'll be out there to tutor for the next 6 weeks. And so we have what we call SNAP teams. But it's very much a process and a system and a series of conversations that just get deeper at each level.
But one of the things we started with was a belief that not all principals had everything that they needed to move their school forward. One of the things the third presentation shared was a central office belief that their role was not to be that directive with schools. When we became convinced that principals did not have the tools, not all of them had the tools they needed to move their...
Or the understanding
of the system or what needed to happen with kids, we began to look for a coaching model that would allow us to be a little more directive but in a very structured way. There aren't a lot of models out there to guide what we did. We found an article that described a Harvard project, and we essentially created it, but it was built on really strong beliefs that we had to get involved as a central office team in order to move change forward in campuses where the principal wasn't able to do it.
Jackie has some.
Yeah.
Sorry, just to follow up. Jackie has some very interesting interventions in. Moving into promoting walkthroughs, we can share that at some point. It's really echoing what you're saying.
I'd like to maybe unpack that directiveness issue a little more. I mean, I think I encounter a lot of superintendents and principals and other folks, and you know, they don't want to be autocratic, they want to be invitational, they want to build shared and distributed leadership, blah, blah, blah. And yet, I think we're seeing and hearing a lot of examples where in many ways we have to be more directive rather than invitational and let action drive belief rather than the other way around. And you know, so we require the school to submit their list of names even though they don't see the value of it, but guess what, after they do that and they work with it for a while, then they see the value, mm-hmm. for example. And so, you know, I think that's an interesting issue. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I wonder, you know, should our districts be more directive in key areas than they are?
I think that's a really dangerous
I don't know.
Place to go.
Yeah.
That it has to be the action before the belief, or the belief before the mm-hmm. action. And that's where some of our work gets to. You know, it's not quite so linear. Change in districts is not so linear. You know, much of the research on districts has shown that if you want to create change, particularly around issues of accountability, you increase the accountability while you increase the flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's exactly what Tony was pointing
right.
out. You set the standard, and everybody
right.
knows then what the standard is, and it's it's putting in the structures, and Jackie said, to make sure they get there.
But there's a tight, loose conversation that goes on initially, you know, what we're trying to do, and this is what we all are held to, and this is where the looseness is. And then those tight, loose conversations change over time with different schools who were either, they're getting it together, and you can see that they know that they're making some progress, and they need that flexibility and that latitude, and others that aren't, and then you have to have that a different conversation.
We have a quote from the
about this issue, and it says the superintendent was just very open. We trade flexibility for results here.
Right. Yep.
So, right. If you're not getting results, you find the scriptures tighter and tighter.
I try to preach that accountability can be liberating.
But that's really the challenge, isn't it? The leadership challenge at the district level is to know when and where to be with each individual institution that you're overseeing.
You have to know the stuff yourself, which I think.
Right, and some of these are, which are enormous, you know, I mean, you've got a
whole complexity. And it's a really tricky issue. I mean, right. And part of what you're saying, Jackie, is that, you know, it depends. And it does depend. You know, some schools have different capacities to do different things. Another thing that depends is what school-level people perceive as flexible versus directive. I mean, one person's right. mandate is another person's invitation to do whatever you want.
That's right. Right, sure.
So in making assumptions about what's a mandate and what's not, what's tight or loose
right.
about direction, you know, something we might, you know, as researchers, we should really make problematic and really
right.
investigate. One lesson I take from that literature, too, is that you know, whether or not something is tight or loose depends on what capacity schools have to take action.
Right.
So we might think about it as a capacity problem rather than a direction mm-hmm. problem.
I was just going to make one observation from working with Jackie on this and really observing her take the district through this. I was really struck by how important her message was in all the data, because I've looked at it several times, and I think that teachers seem to be your charismatic leadership, Jackie. I think there may be other messages here. Very, very important for you to get out and be clear and communicate constantly, and that seemed to be ongoing, but it had huge benefits. It was
in the interviews we did with the 10 schools, the members of the ILTs were very clear about that. They loved it when I came and got in front of their faculties and worked with them, came and visited their ILTs and, you know, visited their classrooms and so forth, which is a pretty regular part of my schedule, although I will say from this morning I'm going to think more about having an assigned day. But that interaction is really important. So as much as the principals play that role in their school, I can't deny that I have a strong voice with the principals. And when you employ them and you appoint them, and then you can give them resources they need to move their project forward, they know that they want to work with you. So you try to use that as an asset.
I think our time is up. But thank you all for coming, and I'm sure the authors are willing to stick around.